today on Against the Grain, some highlights from 2020, from a year's worth of commentary presented on this program. I'm CS. We'll highlight four interviews that I thought stood out on the topics of capitalism and slavery, workers' control and revolution, Harriet Tubman and Andrew Jackson, and energy democracy in the transition to renewables. All that coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. As each year comes to a close, I go through the interviews I've done and come up with a list of favorites. The interviews I conducted in 2020 that we'll highlight today feature four thinkers holding forth on a range of topics. Capitalism is a term we throw around but rarely define. Well, Caitlin Rosenthal offers a definition of capitalism and shares her understanding of how commodification and the power to impose it operated under slavery. Victor Wallace emphasizes the importance of workers' control and examines whether and how workers' self-management was encouraged or instituted during two critical periods in history, the early years of the Soviet Union and the Spanish Civil War. Catherine Squires talks about Andrew Jackson, Harriet Tubman, the Trail of Tears, and the U.S. Treasury's 2016 announcement that Tubman's image would replace Jackson's on the front of the $20 bill. And Ashley Dawson connects energy democracy with the urgent need to transition to clean energy. We begin with Caitlin Rosenthal, UC Berkeley historian and the author of Accounting for Slavery, Masters in Management. We spoke this past January about an essay Caitlin wrote titled Capitalism Where Labor Was Capital, Slavery, Power, and Price in Antebellum America. Caitlin begins this excerpt by describing how the topic of her essay differs from, departed from, that of her book.
Well, one of the things I don't do in the book is attempt to define capitalism, which is a kind of prickly issue that lots of people disagree on and come to from different directions. And I really wanted the book to be about slaveholders' business practices and showing how advanced they were and also how compatible they were with violence and brutality. Having the book behind me, however, there's a really big open question about what slavery has to do with capitalism and whether slavery fits inside the word capitalism, which some people use in positive ways and some people use in negative ways. And this paper is an attempt to define capitalism in a way that helps us to understand slavery's relationship to it.
You write that among the new historians of capitalism, definitions of capitalism are in short supply. Why is that? And maybe you could also just briefly describe who the new historians of capitalism are or what the school stands for.
So to understand what the new history of capitalism is, you have to go back a little bit and realize that for several decades, economic history, especially written by historians, has been out of vogue. People have been concentrating their attention in other areas, so there hasn't been a lot of attention to economic history. Now, there's some work that's gone on, certainly in economics and in other parts of history, but in the main stage of history, other types of work were doing, getting the main attention. So the new history of capitalism is an effort by groups of scholars to return to long neglected or at least disproportionately neglected topics like labor history, economic history, and business history, and to weave those together into a kind of comprehensive account. And one of the first things that the field did was to say, we don't want to wait on having a theoretical definition to get started.
A theoretical definition of capitalism.
Exactly. Because if you have a definition of capitalism and you bring it to the records, then all of a sudden you're already asking, is this capitalism or not? And you're doing a set of classifications that say some things are capitalism and some things are not. And often those things that you're classifying as capitalist and not are actually deeply connected. So we wanted to go into the archives without the definition and look from the bottom up to try to understand how what we would later start calling capitalism was actually operating on the ground. So just to give you an example of this, and one that's highly relevant to the history of slavery, is that many definitions of capitalism rely on wage labor. They say that the rise of wage labor is a key component of the emergence of modern capitalism. Now, if this is the definition you use, then slavery wouldn't be capitalist by definition. So by setting aside the definitions while we go to explore, we can start to see deep parallels and connections in the archive. So in my case, I was able to go to business records from slave plantations, of which thousands and thousands survive, and start to see how those looked a whole lot like those worked in free factories, and sometimes they actually looked more advanced than the ones used in free factories.
So in other words, obviously wages were not paid to enslaved people, and yet you see certain parallels between wage labor and this kind of labor, forced labor, coerced labor?
So if we think back through why wage labor was important to definitions of capitalism, it's not that there's something magical about being paid an hourly wage that makes something capitalist. It's the fact that having an hourly wage usually reflects a power structure where capitalists own the means of production, and they are able to dominate laborers, and they're able to treat them as basically interchangeable, where I don't care if we have a long relationship. I just want an hour of your labor, and if you're not going to give it to me, I'll be happy to have an hour of someone else's labor. The laborer is highly commodified and therefore replaceable. And so that's the kind of connection that I started to follow when I was thinking about new and broader ways to define capitalism. So instead of wage labor, if we say capitalism is characterized by commodification of labor, then all of a sudden you can see these connections between the system of slavery and the system of wage labor, where enslaved people are treated as, to a remarkable extent, considering these are complex, multifaceted human beings, as interchangeable. The unit of analysis is no longer an hour of work, it's someone's entire life. But planters use all kinds of calculations to think about enslaved people as fungible and interchangeable.
You write that the crucial characteristic of capitalism is not commoditization, but the power to commoditize. Elaborate on that.
I think of commodification or commoditization, and I use the two words interchangeably, as a symptom of when capitalism is present. And it reflects the power of an employer, or in this case of enslaved people, an owner or master, to dominate labor. And commodification is like a symptom or reflection of that power.
So we have talked about kind of your understanding of capitalism. How then do you define it in this essay?
Capitalism exists where labor can be highly commodified, and the power to commodify is a reflection of the underlying distribution of capital. Put slightly differently, when capital resources are concentrated into a small number of hands, even if you have a market, the owners of capital will have massively disproportionate power in that market. And that lets them commodify labor, to treat it as interchangeable, which in turn kind of intensifies the same process by which capital is accumulated.
Capital and labor are framed as two separate categories within capitalism. Is it correct to think of enslaved people as labor, as just labor?
So in the discipline of economics today, labor, land, and capital are considered to be the main inputs of production. And slavery seems to confound these categories because labor is also capital at the same time. And what I see in planters' record books is that this fact that enslaved people are both labor and capital is no barrier at all to their owners and business owners seeking to maximize their profits and seeking kind of economic growth. And they do this by triangulating back and forth between the value of enslaved people as capital and as labor. They think about how to extract the most hours every day and make enslaved people work as efficiently as possible during that time. And they, at the same time, regard the enslaved people that they own as, in a sense, pieces of a portfolio of assets that's going to change in value over time. So one of the chapters in my book, which is also discussed in the paper, is about how enslaved people are valued. And planters calculate appreciation and depreciation of every single enslaved person that they own. They sum them up into a kind of portfolio, and then they're able to see if their assets are increasing or decreasing over time. And in the period leading up to the U.S. Civil War, lots of people are getting incredibly wealthy, not just because they can grow a lot of cotton, but because they own a lot of people.
Caitlin Rosenthal is her name, author of Accounting for Slavery, Masters and Management. We're talking about an essay she's written called Capitalism, Where Labor Was Capital. So the last genre of calculation or valuation that you address in this particular paper is enslaved people's efforts to purchase themselves, to buy their own freedom. Now, if prices were attached to their lives in the ways that you've mentioned, if, you know, what a person would bring at auction was kind of set in certain ways, a market price, did an enslaved person simply need to hand over that amount to his or her master in order to be emancipated?
So sometimes that was true, but often it wasn't, and often enslaved people actually had to overpay compared to the market price. And they had to do that because for the slaveholder, they enjoy monopoly power. They own the one and only person who's attempting to purchase their own freedom. And for the enslaved person, that freedom is often priceless. So the master is able to extort more money out of them. And how do we know that enslaved people had to overpay? Well, there's two main sources. One is from slave narratives where people talk about having to pay very large prices, prices that exceed what they're able to pay. And there's even an example from the narrative of William Wells Brown where he talks about being offered the opportunity to choose who he's sold to and then saying to his master, well, couldn't I purchase my own freedom? And then the master refuses to sell him his own freedom. So he's not even allowed to purchase at this market price, the same price that everyone else has access to. The other interesting way we know that enslaved people overpaid is from a clever economic history analysis of the sale of enslaved people in Louisiana around the time of the Louisiana Purchase. Because of the Louisiana Purchase, the land moves under different legal regimes. So it becomes eventually the United States, but before that, it's under the Spanish and the French legal regimes. And in Spain, enslaved people enjoyed a right by law called coartación. Not sure if I'm pronouncing that quite right, but that allowed them to have the right to sue for their freedom at a market price. So they had a kind of guarantee. Now, you still had to negotiate what that market price was, but they had at least some kind of legal recourse. By contrast, in the United States, enslaved people didn't enjoy the right to purchase their freedom at any price. It was much more at the discretion of their owner. And in fact, there were restrictions on manumission to discourage owners from manumitting enslaved people. And this economist, Sean Cole, has basically taken the split of the Louisiana Purchase and compared the prices that enslaved people paid before and after. And he finds that not only are American enslaved people less likely to be able to purchase their freedom, but when they do purchase their freedom, they have to pay about a 20% premium over what the market price would have been. And you can imagine that that premium might have been none for some people and absolutely extortionate for others, wherein an enslaved person's master claims that that person is providing priceless labor in such an egregious price and is able to exploit them in that way.
So what does this tell you, this tendency of many slave owners to increase the price above the market price in order for an enslaved person to gain his or her freedom? What does that tell you about the relationship between price and pricing and power?
The first thing to think about is, you know, not that many enslaved people were successful in purchasing their freedom. It was exceptionally difficult to do and was relatively rare. But I think that even though this case is a little bit rare, it illuminates something about the nature of the commodification that enslaved people faced. Which is to say, the fact that they were reduced to a standard price is not even the real issue. The real issue is that the master is able to choose when and how they're reduced to that standard price. So an owner of an enslaved person can shift back and forth between treating them as a commodity and treating them as unique. And that's because they have this monopoly power over them. So if we think about the prices not as a reflection of some kind of abstract neoclassical economic model that arrives at an equilibrium based on supply and demand, but as a reflection of the power of those people who are participating in the market, that's when you get prices like this, where you have their vastly divergent prices, and these prices are ways that planters are able to exercise other kinds of market power.
Yeah, I see, because if you focus on the valuation practices of the slaveholders, and you just think really about kind of the numbers and the calculations that went into it and the measurements, you might, and I think this is part of your argument, you might not recognize or not think about or ignore the element of power or coercion that's at play.
Exactly. I think it's a particularly vivid of example of something that we do all the time. We think about prices as reflections of supply and demand as if they're somehow neutral. We don't think of them as being just or unjust prices except in extreme circumstances. But if you kind of start to peel back that rhetoric to think about who controls capital and uses it in which way, and you think of market prices as an outcome of those power relations as much as they are an outcome of supply and demand, then you can start to understand that capitalism, far from kind of a neutral market, is actually a market where lots of power is being exercised.
So given all of what you shared with us, is it fair to say that planners pushed for commoditization and enslaved people struggled against it?
Planters certainly pushed for commoditization, but enslaved people were really struggling against the institution of slavery, which sometimes treated them as commodities and sometimes not. For an enslaved person trying to purchase their freedom, it would have been good to be a commodity if they could have at least accessed that same price. But they don't have even that liberty. So really what this shows is that it's all about power. Whether something is a commodity or not is a mathematical kind of way of treating something. But the thing that makes it good or bad to be a commodity is the underlying power relations. It's the fact that planters could dominate enslaved labor, could use extreme violence with it, could threaten to tear families apart. That's the thing that makes the system so bad and so brutal. And the symptom of that system is this commodification, which reflects the replaceability of enslaved people, which is what allowed planters to treat them in this way. And what happens in a capitalist economy is that power is cloaked in what appear to be relatively neutral market forces. It gives this system an appearance of fairness, an appearance of merit, an appearance of having two parties come to an exchange and make that exchange. And what we see in this case of manumission of enslaved people is that they too are in the market. They too can seek to purchase their freedom, but the exchange is fundamentally unequal.
And this relates to, I think, a focus you have, an emphasis you have on labor relations, that without understanding labor relations, you can't understand capitalism. Is that why, or is that partly why, you resist efforts by some people to define capitalism by stressing finance and the role of finance?
Yeah, I think that we have to pay attention to how labor is organized and the ways that people seek labor control. And finance is a big part of that, especially today. I mean, finance can become an instrument of labor control. But really thinking hard about how labor works seems essential to me to understanding how power operates in a capitalist system. And if we think only about financialization and abstraction, then we might miss the operation of labor on the ground.
That's Caitlin Rosenthal. She teaches history at UC Berkeley, and she's the author of Accounting for Slavery, Masters in Management. The essay she and I spoke about was published in Capitalism, a Journal of History and Economics. She joined me in studio in January 2020. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Today, I'm presenting highlights from 2020. We turn next to portions of an interview I did in June with Victor Wallace, former managing editor of the journal Socialism and Democracy, and professor of liberal arts and sciences at the Berklee College of Music in Boston. Victor joined me to discuss his latest book, Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. Here's a portion of that interview. Where did the Bolshevik leadership stand on the issue of workers' control, both in the period before the October 1917 revolution and after it?
Here we have a very clear answer in terms of the actual writings of Lenin himself, who before that revolution was very much in favor of workers' control, but who, in the situation that he faced after the Bolsheviks took power, where they were faced with the extreme urgency of increasing or maintaining production, he had no patience for the kind of experimentation that would be involved in workers' control. So you have direct statements of his to the effect that the entire workforce has to be subordinated to the will of one. That's what he said, underlined. italicized, the will of one. And he explicitly referenced the German model and what he's described their system at that time as being, namely state capitalism. He did not say that it was socialism. He said it was state capitalism, the situation that they had in 1918. And under those conditions, the German enterprise of that time was his explicit model.
And what do you make of that argument that, you know, the nascent Soviet Union was bent on economic growth? It had to catch up with other countries. It saw results as more important, as you write, than processes.
Well, in a way, they were forced into that situation because from the very beginning, they faced the united antagonism of all the great capitalist powers. So they knew, Lenin knew, and the whole leadership knew that they had to build up their own independent industry. And it was a matter of survival for them. So they had no choice. And I think that was the sense of urgency, the sense of not being able to engage in the kind of experimentation in a way that would have been necessary in order for them to work through, you know, all the kinds of trial and error that would be necessary for people previously unfamiliar with operating their enterprises to begin doing so. The urgency of the situation forced them into these kinds of draconian policies.
So then what's the lesson we can take from this part of the Soviet experience, the disinclination toward working toward true workers' control? What does this tell us about whether, for example, whether socialist revolution inexorably leads to the establishment of workers' control?
What I argue is that socialist revolution has to include both the expropriation of the capitalist class and the empowerment of the working class. And actually, there's another chapter in my book where I discuss an excellent book written by Michael Leibowitz called The Contradictions of Real Socialism, where he goes in great detail into this issue as it was expressed later in the process, you know, long after the Communist Party of the Soviet Union was firmly established in power. And you had this situation that although in a positive sense from the workers' standpoint, there was a certain security in the workplace, certain security against being fired, and a certain control over their immediate conditions, that however, the actual structure of authority in terms of what was produced and how it was produced and how much and so on remained completely in the hands of management. So the problem is then generally that they did not do away with the stratification that existed within the capitalist enterprise. And as a result, the society as a whole remained stratified, and the dominant stratum or the superior stratum in terms of power was therefore the one that eventually easily switched over to becoming a capitalist class, you know, in the 1980s. So the point is that in order not to have this kind of reversion to a class society, you have to have democratization in every sphere. And I'd say not just in the workplace, but the workplace is really the central site where this has to be accomplished.
Could one say, Victor, that if the workers had had a kind of a tradition and a traditional way of organizing to enable them to do self-management and to put into effect self-management initiatives, that there might have been a better chance that workers' control could have, if not flourished, at least made important strides in the early Soviet Union?
Well, it's conceivable in an abstract way, but I think all the factors that determined that the first revolution would be in Russia also determined the fact that you'd have a working class that was not, let's say, experienced in terms of regular democratic types of process, such as you could have, at least in principle, in legal trade union activity. I mean, the regime that existed prior to the Bolshevik Revolution was one of extreme repression, and any kind of organization of workers was a kind of a political challenge. It was not really directed towards the ongoing functioning of the enterprise. So when you suddenly had the release from the capitalist power, the immediate impulse, and this is one gets from the accounts of the history of 1917, there was a lot of, there was a certain euphoria at one level, but also it was unstructured. I mean, the people had possibilities, opportunities, whether material or just in terms of living, opened up suddenly that had never existed before. But it was not a situation that was conducive to some kind of discipline and order. And so you did have, by all the documentation I've seen, a certain kind of expression of immediate impulses. And this was not at all conducive to a kind of organized worker control type thing. I mean, one of the things specifically to mention that connection is apparently there was a great amount of drinking. I mean, and drinking alcohol has been always a problem in traditionally in Russia. And this was a kind of situation where it would be indulged in by the workers and so on. And so this was the kind of thing that alarmed Lenin and that led him to think that the only response, given the urgency of the situation, was to exercise dictatorial authority. And he used the word dictatorial in that context.
I want to move now to a portion of this chapter in your book, Socialist Practice on Revolutions, to the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. And many of our listeners may know that there was a left-leaning Republican government that was trying to fight off a revolt staged by forces that came to be led by General Francisco Franco. In which sectors of the economy, of the Spanish economy during these years, was workers' control instituted, and how radical were the changes that were made?
I would say that the it's not a matter of so much of sectors as it is of regions of the country, because the region of the country in which the fascist forces were held off, the region they were not able to occupy until they won a final victory in 1939, was the region especially of Catalonia, of which the principal city is Barcelona. And within that region, it wasn't just Catalonia, but that was the principal region. Barcelona was certainly the biggest city. Within that region, all the sectors of the economy came under, in effect, workers' control, including very much, very importantly, the agricultural sectors. Agricultural collectives were formed spontaneously. When they expropriated the landlords, there was not an interest in dividing it up into individual parcels. There was the impulse was to farm the land collectively. And I think one of the most important and interesting things about it is they also collectively ran the industrial operations and services in Barcelona as well, in the cities. And interestingly enough, from one of the accounts by Gaston Laval, who was a direct witness, since you were no longer employed in particular jobs by particular capitalists, but instead it was part of a community thing, when there was a need to move from one type of occupation to another, for example, even in seasonal terms, in the agricultural work, when it was not needed during the off season, that the workers involved in it could move into other sectors. And there was a kind of movement back and forth that was determined by collective decision, where they were free of the constraints of the market. So it was the fullest illustration of how some of this can happen. And this was under the inspiration, really, of the anarchist culture, which was a cooperative culture, very much that had developed in Spain. And that's one of the general things that I emphasize in the chapter, that the tradition of emphasizing workers' control has been historically associated with anarchism. And as I say, as I argue, this is a great and vital tradition for any kind of socialist movement, but it's not enough by itself, because if you only have that, and if you don't have a political control, then the movement can be suppressed. So what I argue and emphasize in that chapter is that socialism really is a combination of exercising power at the level of the state on the one hand, and having, on the other hand, from the opposite direction, a bottom-up structure symbolized by worker control.
And back to the main argument you're trying to make in this chapter, in this book, what does Spain from the mid-1930s to the end of that decade and the workers' control initiatives that were put in place, worker self-management, democratic workplaces, workers actually participating in the decisions of the business enterprises in which they worked, what does that say about workers' control and the potential that it has and the conditions under which it can emerge and thrive?
It shows, for one thing, that every sector of the economy is one in which it's possible to think in terms of workers' control. And that goes back to an underlying point that I make at the very beginning of that chapter, which is that workers' control of the production process is the most natural thing in the world. It's capitalism that has arbitrarily and unnaturally stripped away the control function from workers and concentrated it in management. So you might say that it's the natural potential of human beings that was emerging in that situation. And if you ask what prompted it to emerge, it was, again, the kind of critical situation that they were forced into. Suddenly, their whole way of life was threatened by this fascist uprising, and everybody had to become active at that moment. And the cooperative culture that had existed among them for a long time was really their source of strength.
Victor Wallace talking with me in June about his book, Socialist Practice, Histories and Theories. His other books include Red-Green Revolution, The Politics and Technology of Eco-Socialism, and Democracy Denied. I'm CS. You are listening to a special 2020 highlights edition of Against the Grain. I'm looking back at and presenting excerpts of some of my favorite interviews from 2020. Another especially memorable guest was Catherine Squires, professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota. She and Aisha Upton wrote an article about the controversy generated by the U.S. Treasury Department's announcement in 2016 that the iconic abolitionist Harriet Tubman would replace Andrew Jackson on the front of the $20 bill. When Catherine Squires joined me in August, I asked about a tragic series of events set in motion by President Jackson. The Trail of Tears. So this occurred between 1830 and 1850, and this involved the forced relocation of tens of thousands of Native Americans from their ancestral homelands in the southeastern U.S. Tell us about this. Tell us about where they were forced to march and what happened to many of them.
Many of the indigenous nations of the Southeast were referred to as the civilized tribes, quote unquote. They were amongst them the Choctaw and the Cherokee were probably the two most, the largest and well-known. And many of them sent their kids to American schools. Many of them, the larger landowners, some of them were also plantation-style farmers, and some of them participated in slave owning. But they were sovereign nations, and they held a great big piece of land that other slaveholders, white slaveholders, Andrew Jackson included, and people of his kind, wanted that land. Some historians say that because of Jackson's experiences in the Revolutionary War, where he lied about his age to be able to fight as a soldier, he was only 13 or 14 years old, I think, when he joined up. He witnessed the British and their Native American allies, of course, attacking the colonists. And so he had a special hatred for indigenous peoples because of those alliances between the British and certain tribes. And so, according to him, the United States should just never have on its borders or within its borders Native American presence. And so he was determined to push out as many Native Americans as possible. And though the Supreme Court ruled against him and said that it would be in violation of the treaties for this dispossession at this scale to happen, Jackson famously just looked at the court and said, all right, you've made your ruling, but who's going to enforce it? And so being the head of the U.S. Army, being the commander in chief, he just did it on his own, even though it was in defiance of the Supreme Court and in violation of treaties with these different nations. And so they forced people to march towards the territories that we now know of as Oklahoma and parts of Arkansas and Texas. And so many people died. The estimates go anywhere as low as 2,000 up to as high as 10,000. And so basically just trying to empty all of those lands, which of course then left room for large plantations to start to take up the space.
Right. And this is a point you make in your article, which is that there is a connection between colonial expansion within the U.S., the American continent, and the economics of plantation slavery, the system of plantation slavery, and that this connection is often ignored, even by progressive commentators and analysts and academics. So what is that connection?
So plantation economics only work with large tracts of land. If you're going to be a small farmer, just to be really grossly economic about it, having slaves do the work for you is not going to be very economically sound if you're just a small family farm. So that's not to say that some small farmers didn't have slaves. There were plenty of small farmers who had slaves or who hired slaves from larger slave owners to help at certain times of harvest, etc., right? So this isn't like small farmers good, large farmers bad. But the point is, in order to have a large tobacco plantation or a sugar plantation or a cotton plantation, if you want to make a lot of money, you need a lot of land. And you need tons of land so you can rotate crops as well, because these crops, like cotton, take so much out of the soil. It's also back-breaking labor. So you need lots of people. The idea of having slaves do this labor, of course, is something that has been naturalized, right? The idea that Europeans kept importing slaves, and then after the cessation of the slave trade, using methods like sexual exploitation and rape to continue to to make women give birth to people who would be enslaved. So in order to have the land, you have to get rid of the people who are on it. And so because Native Americans, indigenous tribes, controlled so much land that was fertile and would be very economically advantageous for plantation owners, there was lots of foment in the Senate, in the House, by local, state, and governors to continue to dispossess indigenous people. And so when you look at some of the new research that's gone out in the archives, I think Johnson's River of Dark Dreams is one of the best of these. You see how pushing to the Mississippi and beyond becomes really a conversation of slaveholders who are talking about the riches that they would be able to realize if they were able to not only get more new states in the Union where they could buy land, but also if those states would be slave states versus coming into the Union as free. So taking out indigenous people and then installing plantation owners on all that land that came through the Louisiana Purchase, which, by the way, didn't happen with the assent of indigenous people, but with the French who said, we own it. That is one of the engines pushing for that to happen, was Southern slave owners who wanted to keep slavery alive and make sure that it expanded into those new territories where they knew they could grow cotton, they could grow sugar, they could grow tobacco, and they could continue to get very large tracts of land for a very low price if the government basically seized it.
So in this article, you present a kind of a content analysis. You and Upton examined both mainstream and people of color-oriented news sources to see the ways in which Tubman, Jackson, and the $20 bill controversy were discussed. And we certainly don't have time to go into the results of your analysis, but I did want to ask you, because I found them rather compelling, and I think you did too, about the commentaries of two people, the writer and activist Feminista Jones and the journalist Stephen Thrasher. What position did they take with respect to the announcement that Harriet Tubman would be featured on the $20 bill?
Right. So those writers were of the camp that it wasn't really an honor to put Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill, because that would be to try to wrap her in capitalism. And you can read her story as an anti-capitalist story, because if you think about the ways that slavery was so entwined with the American capitalist system, the way that fortunes were made, the way that contracts were made, the way that people's citizenship and ability to own property versus be property was set up, that her fight to be free, her fight to keep people out of that aspect of our capitalist system, means that you're doing a disservice to her memory by putting her on the currency for which she would be traded, and making her a symbol of capitalism, and knowing how, you know, if you extrapolate from the work she did during her life, particularly after the Civil War, and she went through periods where she was impoverished herself, where she could not find employment, where she had to depend on charity at times, where she had to sell versions of her story to people who, you know, put in things that may or may not have been true. She was exploited by capitalism. And so to make her a symbol of capitalist enterprise for them was an insult. But again, they used the announcement as an opportunity to also bring forward the ways that Black people in particular, but workers in general, have not made progress in terms of well-being, in terms of health, education, social mobility under the current iteration of American capitalism, that there's still huge gaps in employment and wealth for African Americans and other people of color compared to white Americans, and that slavery is part of the reason for that.
I asked Catherine Squires what she herself thought about Harriet Tubman possibly replacing Andrew Jackson on the front of the $20 bill.
For me personally, I think Harriet Tubman should be honored in lots of different ways. I don't think putting her on currency is the first thing that I would have thought of in terms of what to do. And certainly I have appreciated some other very interesting and comedic takes on the idea of Harriet Tubman on the $20 bill, making racists mad that they have to use money that has this Black woman's face on it. So there's one columnist who imagined this scenario where somebody goes to an ATM and they just can't believe they have to actually use this money because it offends their racist sensibilities. So that was kind of fun to read that. So I can see the different vantage points, but I also think that because of the general ignorance about her life, that it would be all too easy for people to wrap her image on the $20 bill into this sort of American exceptionalism narrative where she just becomes this exceptional individual who deserves this honor because she did these amazing, exceptional things, which then resonates with other narratives about Black American celebrities, which is you're the exception to the rule. Other Black people haven't gotten their stuff together, and you're an exception because you are a great sports star, or you went to this university, or you did this extraordinary thing. So for the time being, we can lift you up, but you're an exception. And so I think that's the biggest danger in these kinds of things.
Yeah, and just as you were saying, when the media or a Hollywood film, for example, portrays a, quote, exceptional African-American, the question that is encouraged, as you write, is if this African-American could rise above her or his or their circumstances, why can't other African-Americans?
Right. And that's a pattern that I think filmmakers like Ava DuVernay, for example, are really pushing against. And so you have a new generation of filmmakers that have really kicked down the door, and actors and actresses and producers now. So you've got a new generation of people who are able to tell different kinds of stories and who are able to center different kinds of narratives that aren't just the exceptional person. And that really matters. So if you compare Selma to Mississippi Burning, it's a very different kind of narrative about what the violence of the civil rights movement was about, right? Instead of focusing on two main white characters, as happens in Mississippi Burning, she focuses on the whole community of people that had to be involved in order to make those marches happen. So you see a completely different way of thinking.
Catherine Squires is her name. She teaches communication studies at the University of Minnesota. Her books include Dispatches from the Color Line, African Americans and the Media, and The Post-Racial Mystique. We spoke in August about an article she co-authored for the volume Racialized Media, The Design, Delivery, and Decoding of Race and Ethnicity. Our final featured voice in this special 2020 Highlights edition of Against the Grain belongs to Ashley Dawson, who argues in his new book that a decisive shift toward renewable energy is impossible without a collective struggle to take back control of the grid. When I spoke last month with Ashley Dawson, a professor and climate justice activist, I asked what happened with wind power in the German village of Feldheim and why he found it instructive and inspiring.
Yeah, the Feldheim case is worth looking at in some detail because it's exemplary of what I'm talking about when I discuss the energy commons. So, you know, one of the dangers of something like wind power is that a big for-profit corporation can go in and set up a wind turbine on someone's land and offer them a small amount of royalties. And, you know, they'll be quite happy to have made something off this big monstrosity in their backyard. Meanwhile, their neighbors will be incredibly angry because they'll see this eyesore in front of them every day, and it will not only mar the landscape, but will also remind them that they're not getting anything out of this resource which their neighbor is benefiting from. So, you know, while we might be thinking of renewable energy as some kind of utopian positive thing that we should struggle for, my point throughout the book is we need to think about structures of governance. We need to think about democratization of this resource if we're going to have the transition move forward. And so Feldheim is really instructive in that regard, because what happened is that the people living in the village, and, you know, it was a village in the German countryside, they're basically farmers living in this village, rather than seeing, you know, just a few people of the village benefit from wind turbines on their land, instead they banded together as a co-op and they negotiated with an energy authority, not one of the big investor-owned ones, incidentally, but with a kind of not-for-profit entity. And so when a series of wind turbines were put up, the proceeds went into a collectively constituted kind of popular bank in the town that led to really concrete improvements in the town, including, for instance, electrification of football fields so that there would be light for people to play football in, but also even more important things like the creation of kind of a biogas plant in the town so that people could use some of the refuse from their farming to also generate electricity. And ultimately, what Feldheim was able to do with the proceeds that they were making from the turbines, you know, from this form of energy democracy in their backyards, was to take over control of the grid, right? So the grid was no longer being run by some outside authority, you know, that was running for profit, but rather they were actually able to control the grid. And this is really important because the arguments that a lot of investor-owned utilities make, and that includes ones here in the United States, is that they can't allow too much renewable energy into the grid because renewable energy is not dependable. You know, it is only around when the sun is shining or when the wind is blowing, and so you can only have a certain percentage in the grid. And so they want to actually slow the transition down, making these kinds of technical arguments about what the grid can bear. So by taking over the grid, the villagers in Feldheim were able to show that, in fact, you could have a massive amount of renewable energy in the grid and that it wouldn't mean that electricity would crash and that they could actually have meaningful forms of control of their destinies.
Ashley Dawson, he teaches at the Graduate Center, City University of New York, and the College of Staten Island. His new book is People's Power, Reclaiming the Energy Commons. And that concludes this tour of some of my favorite interviews from 2020. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.